Good morning. My name is Jared Hammond, and I am a member of your Board of Trustees. Welcome to East Shore Unitarian Universalist Church. I would like to extend a special welcome to any newcomers who are with us this morning, and I encourage you to spend some time getting to know us. If you would like to be on our mailing list, we invite you to sign up at the greeters table. You will find additional information at the pamphlet rack in the narthex. Our greeters will be happy to answer any questions. Please join us for coffee and conversation in the back of the sanctuary following the service. If you have not already done so, please turn off or silence your cell phones or other electronic devices, and please check your order of service for announcements and calendar information. You may also find it helpful to visit the newsstand at the rear of the sanctuary. Finally, what modest task could you do to help our church community? Please find a volunteer opportunity you would like to say yes to and sign up for it on the volunteer opportunities chart in the narthex. Whatever the faiths you have known or the flags of your heritage, you are welcome here. Whoever you are and whomever you love, you are welcome here. And whether you ran in here today on little feet or walked in briskly or ambled in or rolled in, you are welcome here. Now let us be present for one another in worship and love.
I'd like to invite you now to rise as you're willing and able and open your gray hymnal to number 298, Wake Now My Senses. Goodness, it's good to be back. How does one address a mystery, Gordon McKeeman asked, way back when he was the last president of the Universalist Church of America, before it consolidated with the American Unitarian Association in 1961? Cautiously, he said, let us go then to the end of our certainty, to the boundary of all we know, to the rim of uncertainty, to the perimeter of the unknown that surrounds us. How does one address a mystery, he asked, reverently, Let us go with a sense of awe, a feeling approaching the powerful holy whose lightning slashes the sky, whose persistence splits concrete with sprouts, whose miracles are present in every place, in every moment. One addresses a mystery hopefully out of our need for wholeness in our lives, the reconciliation of mind and heart, the conjunction of reason and passion, the intersection of the timeless with time. One addresses a mystery quietly, unless he's 13 months old. For no words will explain the inarticulate or summon the presence that is always present, even in our absence. And so we gather here under this beacon of promise that the mystery will continue to draw us forward together as we love, revere, discover, and connect.
We light our chalice today with the words of Jennifer Leola Gray. Universal mystery, guide us away from the desire to shine light in all the corners. Teach us to embrace the night, for without the darkness, we never see the stars.
So this is the first Sunday of the month. And you know what we do on the first Sunday of the month, right? Can you hear me through this?
Yeah.
Good. So you know what we do through the first Sunday of the month, right? We collect food for people in need in our community. And this Sunday, the food all goes to the pantry at Old South Church. So I'd like to invite you to come forward and put your food into the wagon. Okay, so obviously this is something I hadn't. That's what I was just about to say. Wow. You know, you're gone for a month and phew, like. So while that's happening, while we're bringing the food forward, let's sing number 1010, We Give Thanks. Remembers photo albums. I don't see a lot of younger hands going up. So photo albums, for the younger ones among us who've never seen them, are where we would stick photographs. That was when we snapped pictures with our cameras after we loaded them with film. You know, we'd have them developed into prints that were usually like 4 by 6 inches. And then we'd put them in these books. And we would go back through those books so that we could remember stuff. And it was way different from how it is now. Because, you know, then you had to buy film, and film was kind of expensive. Then you had to have it developed. And that was really expensive. So we were really judicious about the photographs that we took. I'm not kidding. I think that there are like 9 pictures in existence of me from the ages of birth to high school. Because that's the way it was. Right now, I think, though, you know, now we have different ways of taking pictures and storing them, and they're on, you know, Facebook and Instagram and Flickr and whatever all else, right? Reddit, Pinterest, you name it. They're everywhere. I think right now I have something like 10,000 photographs on Flickr. And I've developed about, 12 of them. Until yesterday. So I want to share some pictures with you. So go ahead and take a couple off the top of the pile. Now, if I were Halcyon, I would call this a communion. But this isn't really a communion. This is more like a grab bag. Actually, take two, take three. I think we have enough for that. Don't spend time picking them. Just take what's on the top, two of them. Now, out of the 10,000 pictures, these were the 150 first ones I came across that I wanted to print. Because they're all pictures of events here in this congregation that I've been to, that I got to take pictures of. And each one of them brings back a special memory for me. Every single one of them. And even though there's 150 of them, I don't know, I think I've probably taken 1,000 pictures here since I arrived of the congregation. I couldn't have printed 1,000, even though I would have loved to. And even with all of these, there's still so much that's missing. There are events where I never got a chance to pull my camera out. There are people who, I don't know, for some reason I just never got a picture of. I wish that I had a picture of every single person who's in this room today, but I didn't know who was going to be here today. There are pictures of people who've passed on. There are even some pictures in there of people we haven't seen in a while. And if you've got one of those pictures, if you have a picture of somebody that you haven't seen here on at Eshore in a little bit, you have a special assignment this week. Call that person and say, hey, I haven't seen you at church in a while. What's up? We miss you. So who's got a picture that they want to share that like really brings back a memory for you? I'm hoping that you got stuff that may be completely new to you, but who got one that's...
You know him. Norman Scherer, I have the picture of him, and he died in 2017. So I can't call him, but I'll think about it.
So what's really cool about that picture, Linda, is that his daughter, Sally, who is a Unitarian Universalist minister, called me and asked me if I would take pictures of her parents' leaves on the memorial out in the narthex. So that's what that's from. Anybody else? Karen.
I have a picture of you and Jared.
And we're both wearing blue shirts, black vests, and bow ties. Okay, and what I noticed while you were up there? Your new glasses are almost exactly like mine. Are you trying to become like a maxi me?
I have a picture of the silent witness.
Oh, the silent witnesses. Yeah, it was really hard to not print 1,000 pictures of that. That's a really, and I think that was from the Sunday when our newest silent witness was put up and her family came to visit. What was her name? Nicole Devine. Yeah. Anybody else?
Oh. I have a picture of our last coming of age group, and it's one of their silly pictures where they're all going,
That was just, 2 months ago? Autumn.
I have a picture of you and a bunch of your guy friends and your husband holding a church flag, and you're all wearing high heels.
We were all wearing high heels. So, you know, in all fairness, though, David Domansky is not wearing high heels because his feet are so enormous. He couldn't find any that size. He just painted an old pair of loafers pink. But that was when we walked a mile in her shoes, which is an event designed for men to draw attention to the issue of violence against women and to put out this message that only men can change that. Only men can get other men to stop abusing. Anyone else? Maura.
I have a picture from Halloween a few years ago where we had all the witches.
Yeah. Oh, that's a good one, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Oh, you know what's really great about this picture? All of these people are still alive. No, really. I mean, we've had a lot of deaths in the last 4 years, and there's, you know, 15 women in that picture. And, you know, Marilyn and Diana and Margie are all still with us. Ken.
Here's another picture of you and Barb Fried.
Barb Fried, yeah, she just moved to Portland. Yeah. Another lovely woman and still alive. So you'll notice that a lot of these pictures are selfies with me and another person, right? So, somebody else? Kathleen? Who are you pointing at? Oh, in the choir. Judy, sorry.
Marie had a picture of Rev Denis with Lorna Kramer, and Marie didn't have the opportunity to know Lorna, so she had to ask me who she was. Did you want to say anything?
Oh, wow. Lorna was one of those amazing people that I knew through reputation before I knew any of you all. And Keith Cron, who was the transitions director of the UUA, who connected me with you, who kind of sent me here as your minister, was really dear friends with Lorna for 25 years. And boy, I heard a lot about her. So, that picture, like many of them that you have, are typical of pictures that I take. They're arm's-length selfies with another person. So what I want to ask you to do now is if you have a phone with a camera capability, or if I can't even imagine if you have an actual camera that only takes pictures, take that out and take a picture of yourself with somebody next to you, or maybe a group of people next to you. And then take a picture of other people in the room. Seriously, I'm not kidding. Like, actually do this. I'm even going to do it with my iPad. I love this. Choir, you doing it?
Yes.
Okay.
That's great.
I'm going to get a picture of Marge.
Yeah.
Smile, Marge. Pretend you like me. Okay.
I like the other one.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You can put antlers at her.
Oh, good. You're having fun doing this. Now, this is the really good part. I want you to send your pictures to me. Okay? So since it seems like everybody has pulled out a phone, you should be able to either text it to me or email it to me. So the email is really easy. It's minister@eastshore.org. You got it? And if you want to text it to me and you don't already have my phone number in your cell phone, it's 440-941-9102. Does anybody need that again?
Yes.
Okay. You got yourself set up to put my phone number in? Okay. 440-941-9102. And just hit send. Send them to me. And what I'm going to do is print all these pictures out. So once again, I will have the great joy of being able to send those to the developer and then go and pick them up and be so anxious that when I get to my car, I open them because I can't wait to get home. The other great thing about this phone number is that now you have my phone number, if you didn't already, in your speed dial. So that if anything comes up, you can reach me. You don't have to go to your directory. Okay? I hope everybody's just had my cell phone number in your phone. Cool, but you got it, right?
And for those of you who don't have phones with you today, feel free to do it when you get home. Just take some selfies. So, why don't we sing the children to their religious education classes with number 413, Go Now in Peace. You know, this for me is the most important part of our time together each week, when we share our joys and cares with one another, our hopes and dreams for our own lives, and the lives of the people we love. This is how we mark the passage of time, elusive as it is, and slow it down. And remember that our time is now. This part of our liturgy is important and meaningful, not because of the details of the ritual, but because of its aim: to build connection and compassion among and between us as we care for each other and the world. It doesn't really matter if we light candles or place glass beads into water, as other congregations do, or, as we're going to start doing on homecoming weekend, collect small stones on the altar. What matters is that we engage in the ritual together, approaching it with open hearts that want to grow larger with each milestone shared from this book. This morning, we share the joy of lifelong member Mary Schoeniger, who has just moved to a new West Side apartment to be nearer to her beloved Al. I'd like to invite you all to make the effort to stay in touch with Mary, especially in the coming weeks. You know, her memory is declining, and there are times when she feels really isolated, even a little afraid. And just getting a phone call or a card from any one of us helps ground her in her own past, in her own memories. Okay, I'm having a hard time reading this. Tuesday afternoon, July 31st, my first great-grandchild was born in Franciscan Hospital, Cleveland. Kaya Briella Harrell is healthy and home with parents and dog. Who wrote that?
Marie.
Congratulations. That's really exciting. For these and all the other joys and cares that remain unspoken, we observe a moment of silent meditation.
invite you now to come forward and light candles for your home and for your intentions.
Spirit of life all around us, you've gathered us together in a swirl of healing wind. Take this newfound apprehension, an unwelcome shawl heavy upon our shoulders, and make of it a comforter, soft and warm and trusting, in which we might rest our weary souls. Each day when we awaken, may our first thought and vision be the peace in the eyes of our siblings and cousins, who also see the peace in our eyes. And from this gaze into each other, may the peace of our hearts heal one another. The words of Marta Valentin.
Thank you.
My first opus was definitely an experience. For those that don't know, Opus is a continental-wide spiritual retreat for young adults, 18 to 35. The retreat rotates around the country, and often no 2 years are quite alike. The first time I went, I considered it a remake of Lemony Snicket's A Series of Unfortunate Events. If it could go wrong, it did. No, really. I was set to fly from Cleveland to BWI. The camp was roughly an hour from Baltimore. It was my first time flying alone and my first time flying post-9/11, which those of us old enough to remember is a whole different world. About a week before I flew out, we got a 100-year storm, which threatened to prevent me from even leaving my neighborhood. 24 hours or so before I and half of Opus were set to fly out, someone was caught trying to bring a bomb made of liquids onto a plane. Airports across the country slowed to a near standstill due to increased security measures. This was long before I ever owned a cell phone, so I remember calling my dad, Collect, to have him relay messages to the poor travel coordinator on site, who, of course, was frantically trying to rearrange shuttles for Opus travelers who were anywhere from hours to days late. And then rides to stores as half of us arrived without shampoo or most of our toiletries. Even once everyone arrived, that particular year was plagued with mishaps. A food snafu that caused shortages, multiple medical emergencies and injuries, myself among them. By the second day, I was so physically exhausted I couldn't walk further than the distance from the main building to the campfire circle. I was in pain, miserable, and raw. It would have been reasonable for anyone to assume that this was the worst trip of my life, but it wasn't. Instead, it was amazing and life-changing. I had some of the most spiritual experiences of my life and made connections that over a decade later are strong parts of my life. Yes, part of me did feel like I needed a I Survived Opus t-shirt, but I wouldn't have given up that first Opus experience for anything. Today's reading is called Eunice, by Julia Shaw from her book, The Memory Illusion, Remembering, Forgetting, and the Science of False Memory. When we define ourselves, we may think about our gender, ethnicity, age, occupation, and the markers of adulthood we have achieved, such as completing our education, buying a house, getting married, having children, or reaching retirement. We may also think about personality characteristics, whether we tend to be optimistic or pessimistic, funny or serious, selfish or selfless. On top of this, we likely think about how we compare to others, often directly monitoring how our Facebook friends and LinkedIn connections are doing to see whether we are keeping up. However, while all of these descriptors may be more or less appropriate ways of defining who you are, the true root of your you-ness almost certainly lies in your personal memories.
Last week, I was visiting a friend at her office in Northern California. She works for an agency that represents literary talent, and they book speaking engagements for them. People like Eve Ensler and Michael Pollan and David Sedaris and Kathleen Norris and Anne Lamott. Some of my favorite writers. And we learned that Anne Lamott had been there earlier in the day. So I was telling Holly and her coworkers about how just before Joe and I left California, we went to a writer's workshop with Ms. Lamott, attended by 298 women, plus Joe and me. Everyone laughed, and Joe stopped me. We weren't the only men there, he said. There were three others, so that means there were 295 women. My version of the story is funnier, I insisted. Then one of Holly's coworkers said, with a little twinkle in her eye, "But you're such a liar." Now, I knew she was kidding. At least I hope she was kidding. The truth is that in my memory, we were the only two men in the room. Maybe it's because we were sitting way up front and we were the last to leave, like the nerdy church boys that we are. Or maybe it was because I was the only man to ask a question of Ms. Lamott during the Q&A. As I told that story to those women in that office that day, I was sure that there were 298 women in that room 4 years ago. But memory is a funny thing. It's slippery. We change our memories as much as memory changes us. And our own memories are changed, are affected by the input of others. Memory is mutable. Julia Shaw, the author of The Memory Illusion, argues that memory is where the root of an individual's identity lies. And she says it shapes what we think we have experienced, and as such, what we believe we are capable of in the future. Shaw, a German-Canadian psychologist who has spent her career studying false memory, was asked frequently about Brian Williams back in 2015 when he was fired from his position as anchor on NBC Nightly News. You may remember that Williams had told a story about being in the field during the Iraq War and almost being shot out of the sky in a helicopter that had to make an emergency landing. It turns out he wasn't in the helicopter that had been hit. He was in a helicopter that came later, about 20 minutes or so later. Shaw argues that in general, we tend to mix up our memories. Stories change slightly with each telling. Details become blurry so that we become more of the center of each memory, even if we were just peripheral in the actual event. And it's perfectly normal. Everyone does it, quite subconsciously, to varying degrees. About Brian Williams in particular, she wrote, "Given the nature of the work that I do, I cannot help but try to contextualize the immediate jump to the conclusion that he was making it up. To me, it seems premature to pull out the pitchforks when we aren't sure why everyone is giving an inaccurate account, mostly because we can unfortunately never actually tell apart unintentional and intentional fabrication unless the person later tells us that they were lying. What it definitely does to bring to light, however, is a core assumption that many people make about memory. To me, it very much seems like what happened in the Chopper Whopper scandal was that Williams was accused of being a liar, at least in part, because our general assumption is that no one could possibly misremember such an emotional event. But is that really the case? The bottom line is that we all have false memories, even those of us who are paid to report accurately. And our false memories can cause a lot of problems for ourselves and others. Shaw's research has made many in the justice system question whether anything can be proven beyond a reasonable doubt when it relies exclusively on memory recall. But this morning, I won't even go down the rabbit hole of the criminal justice system and the unreliability of witnesses. Even though our memories are so unreliable, ultimately, they help us shape our identity. They help you shape your you-ness. But why would we want to make memories if they're so unreliable? Even for Shaw, the value isn't in the memory. It's in the meaning of the memory. She wrote, "I remember lying awake for hours as a little girl, unable to fall asleep because I was so engrossed in thought. Lying on the top bunk of my bed, I would press the soles of my feet against the white ceiling of my room and reflect on the meaning of life. Who am I? What am I? What is real? While I did not know it at the time, this was when I began to become a psychologist. Those questions are about the core aspects of what it means to be human. As a little girl, I had no idea that I was in such good company when I could not figure out the answers." It's something third grader Gavin Luckwitz now knows. Back in May, as part of his affirmation as a Unitarian Universalist, he asked us in worship, "How do I know I'm not the only one who is real and that everyone else doesn't just live in my imagination?" Now, before the service, he prefaced it by saying that it was a question he knew couldn't be answered. Maybe he mistook the exercise for a game of Stump the Chump. I don't know. I do know that neither Halcyon nor I answered the question to his satisfaction. But I talked to him about the whole event the other night, and he told me the important lesson that he learned. He now knows he's in the company of great thinkers like Immanuel Kant. And that matters because by simply asking the question, he's beginning to make meaning of his life, to climb what one researcher calls Mount Maslow. Now, you probably know about the hierarchy of needs articulated by 20th century psychologist Abraham Maslow, a professor at both Columbia and Brandeis universities. Maslow's hierarchy of needs is a pyramid, and at the bottom of the pyramid are the physiological needs that we all have for water and food and rest. And at the next level are safety needs, security, shelter, warmth, being out of the elements. After that, right in the middle of the pyramid, come our needs for belonging, love, intimacy, friendship. The need for sex, as most of us know, comes only after we've eaten and rested and are in a warm, dry, safe place. And nearing the top of the pyramid come our esteem needs, finding self-worth through external accomplishments, and the affirmation, the validation that comes from others. And at the very top of the pyramid, at the absolute pinnacle, is self-actualization, or reaching our full creative potential. That's the part of our lives after we've taken care of all of our other needs in which we begin to make meaning of our lives, to engage in the mystery, to find our place in the universe, and understand the impact we've had on the world and the people we love. If you think about Maslow's hierarchy of needs, not as a simple pyramid, but as a mountain that we climb our whole lives, the part at the top, the part about meaning-making, that's the part with the best views, the part that makes the climb through fulfilling all of the other needs worth the work. Making meaning is what matters in life. Julia Shaw learned that when she was a little girl, putting her feet on the ceiling above the bunk bed as she pondered the mystery of life. Gavin Luckwitz learned that when he asked an unanswerable question. Now, the thing that plagued Abraham Maslow for most of his career was one unanswerable question. Why don't more people self-actualize, make meaning from their lives if all of their other needs are met? Why do so many of us stop at finding self-worth through affirmation of others? Why don't more people ponder the mystery? Maybe most of us just don't know how to address it. Gordon McKeeman, in this morning's call to worship, suggested we approach the mystery cautiously, reverently, quietly, and hopefully. To approach the mystery cautiously, embracing the unknown, seeking answers to the questions we know are unanswerable. To approach the mystery reverently, awestruck by the power of Mother Earth and the power of our relationships. Awestruck by the progression of millennia and the expansive miracle that exists in every single second of life. To approach the mystery quietly, knowing we can't do it alone, that we have to listen more than we talk, mindful of how easy it is to miss. To approach the mystery hopefully, needing wholeness in our lives, which we'll find only at the intersection of reason and passion, making memories and making meaning. We just have to be willing to approach the mystery openly and suspend our need for concrete results we can measure or even explain. Then at the end of his prayer, the part that I didn't read earlier, McKeeman asked, "What shall I say?" "Anything," he answered. "Any anger, any hope, any fear, any joy, any request, any word that comes from the depth of being addressed by being itself." or perhaps nothing. No complaint, no request, no entreaty, no thanksgiving, no praise, no blame, no pretense of knowing or not knowing. Simply be in the intimate presence of mystery, unashamed, unadorned, unafraid. I like my memories. I like all the pictures I've taken and the reminiscing they spark. But what I value more are the ways in which they get me to understand my life and my place in the world, giving me direction for the future. The pictures of children in the congregations I've served remind me to live up to the expectations they put in me. The pictures of elders who've passed on remind me to be part of the complex web of their existence and to continue their legacies as they worked for justice. You know, the picture of Lorna this morning was particularly touching in that moment. As I left the house this morning, the pictures were all in a pile, and that one of Lorna was right on top. And Joe looked at it, and he got really teary, and I, what's going on? I thought it was the new eye drops he's using. And he said, I can see in this picture, just by the way you're looking at Lorna, that you really loved her. And it's true. The pictures also remind me to make art as an act of restoration and an act of community building, an act of justice making. And even though I don't think Lorna would have ever considered herself to be an architect, an artist, justice is art. So these pictures, every single one of them, but especially the ones in which I'm wearing that yellow clerical shirt as an act of public witness to injustice, remind me that every single moment of every single day, I have a sacred responsibility to every person in my life, a responsibility for every person in my life, a duty to the whole world that I can't ignore. Those pictures remind me of my commitments and the incredible views I can get from the top of Mount Maslow if I climb to the top beyond just getting affirmation from others. Those pictures remind you to be unashamed, unadorned, unafraid of the mystery, to climb up and see it. But I still prefer to think of myself and Joe as being the only two men in that room with Anne Lamott. I'd like to invite you now to rise as you're willing and able and open your gray hymnal, this time to hymn number 6, Just As Long As I Have Breath.
Yes to life.
There aren't many pictures left in these baskets. There's only three, but the one on the very top is Kellen Ray. And if Kellen Ray were here, I'm sure that he would want to tell you to give as generously as you can to supporting the work of this church. This morning's offering will now be accepted, and if you're visiting for the first time, please let the collection basket pass you as our guest. Thanks for being here.
As a member of the Board of Trustees, I would like to thank you for your attendance today and for all the gifts you have brought with you. The gift of your presence, the gift of the care you give to one another, and the gift of the financial resources that you share with all of us. Please know that these financial resources are used with diligence and care by your finance committee and your board to help sustain this caring community.
Our benediction is from a poem called The Opening of Eyes by David White. Life is no passing memory of what has been, nor the remaining pages in a great book waiting to be read. It is the opening of eyes long closed.
With the dawn to sing awake the light and softly serenade the stars ever dancing circles in the night. May your life be as a song resounding with the dawn to sing awake the light and softly serenade the stars ever dancing circles in the night. And softly serenade the stars, ever dancing circles in the night.
Ever dancing circles in the night.
So, a few quick announcements for you. On Wednesday night, the Finance Committee is meeting in advance of the board meeting next Sunday, which will happen after coffee. On Thursday evening, we'll be meeting for beverages and banter at the Panera on Wilson Mills Road in Highland Heights. I'm just beginning to plan all the B&B events for this coming church year. I just want to remind you that if you know of any really great place that we can meet, someplace where somebody can go in and just order a coffee, that's ideal. Please let me know. One of the new places we're going to be trying is a great little place called Starfish and Coffee in Painesville in a couple weeks. So I want to encourage all of you to come to these things whenever you can. Next weekend, from Friday evening through Sunday morning, just before worship, the young adult UUs from around the region will be meeting here, and they're going to be spending Friday night and Saturday night and really taking over the whole joint. I'll be seeing them on Saturday and inviting them to stay for worship on Sunday.
So when you see young adults here that you don't recognize next weekend, please welcome them, introduce yourself, find out what makes them tick, let them know we care about them. And the Blue Sky Folk Festival is on Saturday the 25th, so that's, what, 3 weeks from yesterday. And I'm sure that y'all still need volunteers for stuff, right? So if you haven't...
Gate workers.
Gate workers. Is that all?
Well, no.
Among other things. So if you haven't signed up to volunteer already, talk to Dan, obviously, or Nancy, or Ricky, or Jerry, or... And if you don't know them, talk to somebody else, and they'll tell you who to talk to, because there's plenty of people to talk to. So now I'd like to invite you all to rise as you are willing and able. And take the hand of the person next to you if you're up for it. If you're feeling strong and healthy enough and want to make that kind of connection, you're welcome to do it. And if not, it's fine. If you don't know the words to the Bond of Union, they're printed in your order of service. We join hands in Unitarian Universalist Fellowship, pledging ourselves to an individual religious freedom which transcends all creeds, not to think alike, but to journey together.